From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo, we talk with writer Susan Sontag about directing the Samuel Beckett play In a City Under Siege. The show is up and running by candlelight, not spotlights, with a cast that includes Muslims, Croats, and Serbs. Also, putting Perot into context, we talk with Sean Wilentz, professor of history at Princeton, about how Ross Perot fits into the history of populist politicians. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of Leonard Bernstein recordings on Sony. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Mars Observer has failed for a second time to contact Earth, dimming what little hope there was that the mission might be saved. Controllers had hoped the craft would make contact this afternoon following an onboard computer program that tells the billion-dollar probe to call home if it hasn't heard from Earth for 5 days. In New York, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the spiritual leader of some of those tied to the bombing of the World Trade Center and subsequent plot to bomb several New York landmarks, has himself been indicted today in those bomb plots. NPR's Maria Hinojosa has more.
The indictment states that Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman was a leader in an international terrorist organization headquartered in New York City. Up until today, Rahman, who was being held awaiting deportation, had not been charged with any criminal wrongdoing. But the indictment released today established the Sheikh as a mastermind of a series of terrorist plots aimed at the U.S. government. The Sheikh is also charged with conspiracy to kill Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. For the first time, this indictment officially ties the two separate bomb plots in New York City, the World Trade Center bombing in February, where 6 people were killed, and the plot to bomb several New York landmarks. A total of 15 suspects are listed in the indictment, including El Sayed Nasser, who was previously acquitted in the murder of Jewish radical leader Meir Kahana. The suspects will be arraigned tomorrow afternoon. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
An aid convoy reached the southern Bosnian city of Mostar today. The trucks loaded with food and medicine for the besieged Muslim enclave were held up by Croat protesters in a nearby city. Croats have been trying to drive the Muslims out of Mostar, which they want is the capital of their lands in Bosnia. The Armenian forces fighting in neighboring Azerbaijan have advanced to within 10 miles of the Iranian border and captured 2 strategic towns. Tehran reports Armenian forces have fired into Iranian territory and says the tens of thousands of refugees are heading for the Iranian frontier. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
Armenian forces surged closer to their goal of controlling almost the western third of Azerbaijan when they drove Azeri troops from 2 of their strongholds and pressed southward toward the Iranian frontier. They're continuing their advance in defiance of the UN Security Council's demand last week to withdraw from Azerbaijan. Peace talks over the last 5 days have achieved little, as Azerbaijan has been tackling a second separatist rebellion in the southeast. Meanwhile, Iran, which has its own large Azeri population, is increasingly alarmed about getting dragged into the conflict and the impending refugee emergency on its northern border. According to Tehran's official news agency, Armenian forces have fired rocket launchers into Iran. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at a record 3652.09. Advances led declines on volume of 302 million shares. This is NPR News. In Nicaragua, there are reports the hostage siege may be ending, but the political crisis continues. The Secretary General of the Organization of American States has announced he will go to Nicaragua to help mediate the political difficulties in that Central American country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
João Baena Soares made his announcement at a special session of the OAS, convened to decide what action it might take to address the tensions which led to the hostage crisis between leftist Sandinistas and right-wing Contras. He said he would consult all sides and let them decide what kind of mediating role he should play. Baena Soares said he had spoken earlier with the Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro and that she had requested that the OAS expand on its efforts to help resettle combatants from the 8-year-old civil war. Former soldiers from both sides are angry that the government has not fulfilled promises of land after the war. Representatives for the United States pledged $5 million for the mediation effort. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The United States today announced economic sanctions against China and Pakistan for alleged violations of international arms controls. The State Department said the sanctions would affect American exports of items that can be used in military applications, as well as electronics, military aircraft, and space systems equipment. The restrictions are expected to cut off about $500 million a year in exports over the next 2 years. Five labor unions today asked the federal government for help in protecting workers from on-the-job exposure to tuberculosis. The Labor Coalition to Fight TB in the Workplace pointed to a 20% increase in TB cases since 1985. Namco Limited and Magic Edge Incorporated today announced a venture to open virtual reality entertainment centers in the U.S. and Japan. Namco, based in Japan, is a video game developer and operator of theme parks and arcades. Magic Edge is a developer of entertainment-based interactive full-motion flight simulators. The entertainment centers will house Magic Edge full-motion simulators. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Susan Sontag was in North Vietnam during the war and in the Golan Heights when Israel was fighting with its Arab neighbors. But nothing she ever saw there compares, she says, to the misery and the desperation of Bosnia today. Susan Sontag visited Sarajevo in April for 2 weeks and just returned from a 6-week stay where she directed Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Sontag is best known as a writer of social criticism and essays. Her latest book, a novel, The Volcano Lover, is just out in paperback. When Susan Sontag went to Sarajevo, she found only 2 existing theaters and no functioning theater companies. She held auditions for 3 days and assembled a cast and crew of Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. Sontag told me why she chose to mount that play in that place.
I have to admit that it was so obvious to me that I didn't even think about it. It is, although it was written, 40 years ago, I guess. It was first performed in Paris in 1952, if I'm not mistaken. It seems as if it was written for Sarajevo. It's about abandoned people, weak, vulnerable people, waiting for something to happen that they go on hoping against hope will happen, and yet it's perfectly clear it's not going to happen, and that's the situation of the people of Sarajevo.
How would you describe the Sarajevo that you saw in the spring and the Sarajevo you just returned from? How have conditions changed between those 2 months?
I would say, given that context, but also given other things as well, that the mood is much darker. I think in April people still did have hope. They said over and over again, this is unjust. This is totally unjust. We are a state that has been recognized by all the European states and above all by the United States. Recognition means respect for territorial borders. We can't believe the international community and particularly Europe or the United States is going to let us down. Please go and tell the world what's happening to us. That's what they were saying in April. By early July when I got there, they knew that the world knew and they felt, no, we're not going to be helped. The mood was much, much darker, full of despair. I can't tell you how miserable and indignant people are, but mostly they're just extremely depressed. They're heartbroken. They keep saying over and over again, but we're part of Europe, but we were recognized, but this is unjust, but the Serbs are war criminals and they've committed all these atrocities, but doesn't everybody know about it? The concentration camps, the policy of rape, the continued shelling of the city, which, by the way, even when you read about there being a ceasefire, that doesn't mean that there's no shelling or sniping. It just means that there's less than there is in a normal day. In the first part of the time that I was there in July and August, as many as 3,000 mortar shells fell in the central city. It meant that, you know, so I don't know, 20, 30 feet away from you, somebody was getting killed almost any place you were.
You certainly are describing the desperate conditions in Sarajevo and describing the deep depression that many of the people feel. How are they able to go on with their life? How much of a life do they really have?
Well, you know, as many people have said in literature and in ordinary life, people get used to anything. This is both a horrible and an exalting aspect of human nature. You would be surprised at the degree of normality there. I remember when I went in April, I couldn't believe that I saw children playing on the streets. And I met parents, and I said, how do you let your children go out on the streets? Because something like 3 or 4 children are minimum are killed every day by sniper bullets or by mortar shells fragments. And they said, look, you can't keep your children indoors after 16 months. You can keep them indoors for 2 weeks or a month or 2 months, but life goes on. And anyway, no one is safe in an apartment. During the time I was there just now in July and August, I know a number I remember I went to see someone I know, and he told me that the woman in the apartment just above his had been shot, been hit and killed by a sniper bullet the night before. I was sitting in his living room, you know, one floor below, around the same time that his neighbor had been killed the night before. So it isn't even a question of staying in or going out. People become very fatalistic, and there is a lot of normal life there. I met a lawyer, for instance, a boyfriend of someone that was working with me in the theater, and I said, oh, I mean, even I, who know the place very well now, I said, oh, are there court cases here now? And he said, of course there are. There are sitting courts. I said, are there divorces? He said, more than ever. He said, because people get married very fast now. They don't have sort of normal courtship activities. They can't go to the movies because there are no movie theaters. They can't sit in the park because they'll get killed. So they get married very fast, and there are a lot of 6-month divorces. What's amazing is an awful lot of what you would call normal daily life goes on, except it's Russian roulette. It's a shooting gallery, except you could be killed at any single moment of the day or night, wherever you are, and you have in most, almost all places in the city, including the one functioning hotel, which is where I stayed, no water at any time, no electricity at any time, and very, very little food.
What precautions did you take to make sure to try to protect yourself against the sniper bullets?
None.
None. Why not? Why not?
Because I think I cannot work with people there wearing a flak jacket. I will tell you, I do own one, because in order to get on a UN plane, which is the only way you can get in or out of the city, is by a plane run by the United Nations, which carries soldiers or cargo, it's a rule that you have to wear a flak jacket. So I actually possess one of these things. I wore it to get on the plane in Zagreb, and I got off the plane with it at the Sarajevo airport, which is controlled by the Serbs, but there's a little UN revetment, and I wore it into the city, and I checked into the hotel, and I left it there, and I put it on again 6 weeks later when I went out to the airport to get on the plane. That may seem very foolish, but I felt that I could not come to rehearsal, sit with my actors wearing armor when no one in the city has a flak jacket and no one is protected in the way all foreigners, that is journalists or anybody visiting the city, is. So that was a moral decision. I felt like I absolutely could not do that, that I'm putting myself in a different position. No one told me to do that except one actor about 4 days into the rehearsal process said to me, of course, I wouldn't mind if you wore a flak jacket, but I do appreciate that you don't. But that was the only person who ever said to me that noticed it. But I'm sure everybody noticed it. I felt it was a question of principle, not to live differently from the way they live. I already am in a totally different position. I can leave. They can't. If the city is totally sealed, no one can leave.
Do you get used to the sounds of gunfire?
Oh, if you're asking me if I was afraid, of course I was afraid. And so is everybody else there. I mean, there are few people there who are so depressed that they become, in fact, suicidal. You hear stories about people just strolling, and it's said of those people they were looking for their bullet. Because a lot of people, particularly older people, are in the most terrible despair, and they hold up less well under these circumstances of terrible privation. I mean, most people spend a good part of their day ensuring that their toilet can flush. Because there are springs and public taps in the city, but everybody has to go out and get this water in plastic, plastic jerry cans. And then, since most of Sarajevo is new and modern, haul it up 10 or 15 stories, because obviously, since there's no electricity, no elevator works. And that's what they're doing. A third or half the day is risking their lives to get water, at least half of which goes to keep the toilet flushing so that their bathrooms don't become cesspools. And that's so demoralizing.
What was it like to work with a cast and crew that I'm sure were hungry a lot of the time, certainly were frightened a lot of the time, probably many of them didn't even feel well because of the conditions they were living under?
Yeah, what it was that I was pretty easygoing at the start. And maybe I was easygoing all the way through, keeping my fingers crossed that I'd still get a good result at the end. One or two people said to me, who came in and watched rehearsals, it's funny, I've never told this to anybody, said, you're too nice to them. Don't you know a director has to scream at people now and then and be terrifying and tyrannical?
Are you that kind of a director anyway?
Well, first of all, I'm neither that kind of director nor that kind of person. But I knew that I couldn't scream at these people, even if I wanted to. They were so gallant and so tired, and they all had terrible stories. And so, yes, I was feeling full of sympathy for them and worrying about their problems. I was bringing them food from the hotel. I'm feeding them every morning. I was taking rolls from the dining room in the hotel because, I mean, however inadequate the food in the hotel was, it was still better than what they were getting. We did have our spam and rice and rolls and whatever.
I was going to ask you, yeah, what kind of food were you able to eat there?
Well, it wasn't very much, but it was more than what they had. I noticed how tired they were because they would sit down or lie down every time I stopped the rehearsal for 1 minute to give a correction or suggestion. They'd immediately all drop into chairs or drop to the floor. And actors don't do that. I mean, they stay in place when you talk to them, unless it goes on and on and on. And I wasn't stopping them for more than a minute or two.
So they had no stamina, really?
They had no stamina at all. And the character of Lucky in Beckett's play is a figure of a man who carries a lot of suitcases. He's the figure of a burdened person. And needless to say, the suitcases that the actor playing Lucky in my production was carrying were all empty. And he was having a very hard time carrying empty, very light suitcases, two or three.
They were
made of cardboard, and they were still an effort for him to carry.
My guest is writer Susan Sontag, and she's talking to us from her home in New York about directing Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. She just returned from a six-week stay. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and director Susan Sontag. How multi-ethnic was the cast and the crew? Were there Muslims, Croats, Serbs working together on this play?
Absolutely, and I made no effort to choose people on that basis, but gradually as I got to know them, I found that I had, you know, absolutely a mix. I had people who were completely Serb, completely of Muslim origin, and completely Croat, and I had more than half the people who were of mixed parentage, a Muslim mother and a Serb father, or a Croat mother and a Muslim father, etc. It was because that's what Sarajevo is. And one of the most interesting facts about Sarajevo that I know is in the year before the war started, in April 92, 60% of the marriages in Sarajevo were intermarriages. I think that tells you a lot about the city. The word Muslim is very misleading. And I think awakens a lot of stereotypes. The Bosnian Muslims really have the worst of both worlds. They're regarded as Muslims by the so-called West, that is Western Europe and North America, and they're not regarded as Muslims by the Arabs, by the people of the Middle East, of societies which do still have are still dominated by religious communities. To put it in its simplest terms, the Muslims of Sarajevo, the people I know, are no more Muslim than I'm Jewish. That is to say, they are people of Muslim origin whose families stopped being religious several generations ago. When I would ask people who were of Muslim origin, how much religious observance is there or was there in your family? They would always speak of their great grandparents or their grandparents. I never met anybody whose parents were even observant. And insofar as they were observant, It was a very generic, weak form of religious observance. For instance, nobody I met in Sarajevo, and I'm talking about people who would say they were of Muslim origin, knew the difference between Sunni and Shiite Islam, which is the fundamental difference in Islam. I mean, it's like the difference between Catholic and Protestant. You'd never, if you said somebody who was a Christian and you said, are you Protestant or Catholic, they wouldn't know what you meant. These people weren't even aware of that distinction. So I think as far as Sarajevo goes in the urban centers of Bosnia, what we're talking about are Christian Slavs who were converted 3 or 4 centuries ago when it became a Turkish province, and who always had at most a very diluted, generic form of religious observance, which in urban areas disappeared several generations ago.
What language, then, was the play done in?
The play was done in Bosnian, because that's the language the actors speak, although many of them do speak English. They don't act in English. And anyway, the audience, I want this play to be understood by the audience. That may seem odd to you, but it's really not odd. I mean, Arthur Miller went to Shanghai and directed a production of Death of a Salesman. He certainly directed it in Chinese, not in English. So just a theater director, like an opera director with any experience and any international experience, knows how to do this in a foreign language. All you need is an interpreter. And I used one of the actors who was bilingual as my interpreter. And I could communicate privately with most of the actors in English. But the language in which they spoke the text was Bosnian. And what I did was I had 2 copies of the script. I had an English language copy of Mr. Beckett's script enlarged. And I wrote the Bosnian word by word above the English, and then I had a copy of the Bosnian text, and I wrote the English above it word by word. And after about 2.5 weeks, I could recite the play for you in Bosnian because I heard it so many times. And I always knew what they were saying, and I could say, you know, that line you're saying too fast or not expressively or whatever. It's no different, really, from opera directing, which also takes place in many languages.
Tell us how the play was received.
With enormous enthusiasm. I think it was a big event there. It was a big event that a foreigner came and wanted to stay there and work and do something. It was a big public event. I should add that there is no money economy there. The only money economy is a black market economy, and the currency is Deutschmark. So I was not paid any salary or any expenses. Neither were the actors or any of my crew paid, and the tickets are free. Whatever cultural activity takes place there is not paid, not salaried. You have to imagine an economy in which a pack of cigarettes, I'm talking about Deutschmarks because that's the only currency that counts, a pack of cigarettes is 10 marks. The salary of a surgeon at the hospital is 3 marks a month. So a little over 3 months' work will get you one pack of cigarettes. So everybody who's working there is working for free.
If you hadn't been in Bosnia, would you feel so strongly and so clearly about what you feel that country needs and the responsibilities of the outside world toward that country?
I'll be absolutely honest with you. Probably I wouldn't, but that would be my failure of imagination and knowledge. I think I do feel it this strongly because I have been there. I won't say that I don't. But on the other hand, there are people like Joseph Biden, for instance, Senator Biden, who did actually come there once for 24 hours, but I don't think he saw anything that changed his mind or influenced him. I think he came there with the views that he has already had and subsequently continued to eloquently express. So I think that people who have really thought about this question and are attentive can reach exactly the same conclusions. But I won't pretend that I might have reached the same conclusions had I not fully turned my attention to the place and decided to go there.
Let me get some specifics from you if I can. You support intervention in Bosnia. What would be the targets? What would be the political solution that you would support?
I would support the lifting of the siege of Sarajevo as a demand, among others. the recognition of a viable state of Bosnia, one that could survive, not some kind of sort of apartheid state, which is just what a sort of apartheid mini state of so-called Muslims. Serbia can be pressured into making concessions. The Serbs have total contempt for the United States, and they know that nothing's going to happen, and they thumb their nose at the United States. But whenever there is the slightest pressure, they yield, and they would continue to yield to pressure. Listen, I don't want a single Serb or Croat civilian to die. I'm not bloodthirsty, and by the way, neither are most of the Sarajevans. But I think a combination of no foreign policy has credibility unless there is an intention to use force, a possibility of using force. And there are countless statements by Karadzic and Milosevic and Mladic that show they have complete contempt for the United States. They say things like, "Oh yeah, sure, you bomb our positions on the hills of Sarajevo, we're going to bomb New York." They laugh.
You were against the war in Vietnam. Why do you support U.S. intervention?
To stop a war. I still consider myself an anti-war activist, among other things, among many, many other things. I believe intervention is necessary to stop genocide, to stop this war, to stop this country and these people from being exterminated. There will be 2 million Bosnian refugees, if we're lucky that there are that many who survive. The most of the people in Sarajevo don't fit these ghetto apartheid categories. Where does someone who's half Muslim and half Croat go? Where does someone who's half Serb and half Croat go? Where does someone who, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? This is to stop murder. It's not because I've suddenly discovered the virtues of war.
Will you go back to Sarajevo soon?
I'm going back in 4 weeks.
For another play?
Well, I'm going back to look in on my play, which will have been running continually until I get back, and do a little sort of scotch tape and repairing of various, you know, I mean, any play crumbles a little around the edges when the director is gone for too long. But mainly, I'm going back because I'm so attached to the place, and I want to see friends and bring people. I mean, one of my actors has a heart problem and can't get medicine. That's a reason for going back to bring this woman her heart medicine, to bring batteries to people so they can listen to their Walkman, to bring flashlights and candles, to bring a salami to a person who hasn't seen a salami in 17 months. Say hello to friends. I'll stay there maybe 10 days and try to stop thinking about them round the clock and go back sometime in the winter if there still is a Sarajevo and direct another play, probably a play of Chekhov, I think.
Do you know which one?
Well, I'm very torn. The Three Sisters sounds like a play. I mean, Chekhov also, the mood of Chekhov also fits Sarajevo. A lot of plays fit Sarajevo.
I thank you so much, Susan Sontag, for joining us today on Fresh Air and giving us some of your valuable time.
Thank you very much.
Writer Susan Sontag talking about her experiences directing Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. During last year's presidential election, Ross Perot seemed to some like the newest thing around, a refreshing alternative to politics as usual. But history professor Sean Wilentz says populist Perot merely updated some of the oldest existing currents in our political history. Coming up, a talk with Sean Wilentz. He teaches history at Princeton and has studied American populist movements. And today would have been conductor Leonard Bernstein's 75th birthday. To commemorate, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of Bernstein's work on Sony. Get your wallets ready. It's 100 CDs in all. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Bosnia, a truck convoy carrying nearly 300 tons of urgently needed food and medical supplies has finally reached Mostar. Aid workers began unloading supplies immediately for Croatian residents in the western part of the city, and trucks then entered the eastern part of the city. In the east, some 50,000 Muslims have been waiting for 2 months for full-scale relief aid. Jeremy Bowen reports for the BBC.
The dramatic late-night entry into a city which is under sustained machine gun and cannon fire and sporadic shell fire took the mainly Muslim Bosnian army commanders here by surprise. They'd been told that the UN had given up for the day. Also tonight, the Muslim commanders are due to meet their Croatian counterparts to supervise an exchange of bodies. If that is to both sides' satisfaction, the convoy will be allowed to roll on into the besieged Muslim quarter. Eastern Mostar needs many more convoys like this, but at least it's a start. Delivering the aid will be difficult and dangerous. Shells have been exploding near the makeshift hospital here this evening, but it's expecting much-needed medical supplies.
Jeremy Boeing reporting for the BBC. And for the second night in a row, U.S. Air Force cargo planes airdropped relief supplies to Muslim residents of Mostar. An Air Force spokesman in Germany said it was the largest airdrop to the region yet, and six C-130 cargo planes were involved. Last night, two cargo planes were involved in the airlift. In Washington, the State Department has concluded that China sold ballistic missile technology to Pakistan in 1992. And today, the Clinton administration imposed economic sanctions on both countries. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The State Department says the sale violated the missile technology control regime designed to slow missile proliferation. Neither China nor Pakistan has signed the MTCR, but U.S. law requires they be punished anyway if they violate its terms. Both countries deny any violation. For the next 2 years, U.S. firms, especially those dealing in satellite technology, will be barred from selling specified items to Pakistan and China. There isn't much U.S.-Pakistan trade in these items, but State Department spokesman Mike McCurry estimates American firms could lose up to $500 million a year in sales to China.
And, of course, that's a significant cost that we pay, but it reflects the seriousness with which we look at the issue of proliferation.
And, said McCurry, the sanctions take effect immediately. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 13 points to close at 3,652.09, a new high, on volume of more than 302 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. According to court documents unsealed today in New York City, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman has now been charged with taking part in the bombing of the World Trade Center last year, an alleged plot to blow up key New York City landmarks. The Egyptian sheikh is awaiting deportation on immigration charges, and up to now he had not been formally charged in the Trade Center bombing or the alleged plot to blow up the UN. Some of his followers have been charged in both cases. The sheikh was also charged today, along with three others, with conspiracy to murder Egyptian President Mubarak. In the World Trade Center bombing, six people were killed and more than 1,000 others were injured. In Paris, the French government has announced that it will pull its troops out of Somalia by the end of January. The announcement came as the United States said it was increasing its troops there in response to a call from the UN Secretary General. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Defense Minister François Lyotard said France intends to pull its troops out of both Somalia and Cambodia. France has 1,100 troops in Somalia and 1,500 in Cambodia. Lyotard said French soldiers would pull out as the operations in both countries were drawing to a close. But UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali recently said the organization needed more soldiers in Somalia. Lyotard did not say why he thought the peacekeeping operation in that country could be phased out. He said France had informed the United Nations of its intention to pull out. The French Foreign Ministry spokesman said France had never intended to be in Somalia indefinitely, adding that the French withdrawal had no relation to the reinforcement of U.S. troops there. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The government says that sales of durable goods had their biggest drop in 1.5 years last month. The Commerce Department says that durable goods orders were off nearly 4%, in part because of fewer orders for airplanes and new cars. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The presidential election is over, and Ross Perot didn't win, but he's still out campaigning. He's already held 60 rallies this year where he recruits new members for his United We Stand group. Last Sunday, he spoke in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where he quoted the song 40 Hour Week by the country band Alabama. It goes, "There are people in this country who work hard every day, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay." How this Texas billionaire fashioned an image of himself as a man of the people is the subject of a recent article by my guest, historian Sean Wilentz. His article, Pax Populi, is in the August 9th issue of The New Republic. Wilentz is a professor of history at Princeton University. I asked him how Ross Perot fits into the long tradition of populism.
Well, start with the word populist. The word populist comes from an appeal to the people. Ross Perot primarily or paramountly makes an appeal to the American people against specific political interests that are out there who are supposedly manipulating the political system in such a way as to destroy the country's situation or to erode people's economic situations, etc. So it's his appeal to the people as a kind of undifferentiated mass against a particular group of political insiders that is a characteristic populist theme.
And that theme then has been carried on with different examples of us and them through history.
Precisely. Going back to the end of the 19th century, there was an idea that a small cabal of bankers and international interests, many of them Jewish, had somehow managed to corrupt the American political system, tied it to a gold standard, and was ruining the country. Well, those kinds of thems out there have been a perennial in American politics, whether it's the welfare queens or the welfare chiselers who are undoing the rights of the hardworking American people, whether it's blacks, whether it's outsiders, whether it's Harvard boutique liberals, whether it's any kind of exotic outsider or any kind of political interest that seems to have inordinate power in the face of popular powerlessness, that is the group that is seized upon as being the malevolent force in American political life. What makes Perot different, of course, the obvious thing is that he's the first billionaire in American history to come along and mount this kind of political effort independent of the major parties.
Can you be a billionaire populist?
Well, that seems to be a contradiction. What Perot has done, and quite cleverly too, I must say, is to say, look, the political system is so corrupted by money, it takes a billionaire to transcend all of that. And only a person with my means can avoid the kinds of corruption that we see out there every day with these normal politicians. That's been his appeal. It's an innovative one. At any rate, that's what makes him different. That's what makes Perot different. But in other ways, he's assumed many of the classic small p populist guises, many of their classic positions. One of the things that interests me most about Perot, in fact, is the way that he has managed to come across to the American people as a man who talks sense,
mm-hmm.
common sense, in a way that the normal politicians can't. In this respect, he is playing a role that I've referred to as that of the village explainer. There have been lots and lots of these people over the years, people who, in simple terms, can explain the apparent mysteries of American political and economic life, telling people that things really are much simpler than they appear to be or that the regular politicians are telling them that it is. and proceed to try to explain to people exactly how things operate and what should be done to correct the difficulties.
He has painted himself as an outsider, as a kind of unpolitician, certainly railed against the corrupting influence of lobbyists, the guys in $500 suits and, mm-hmm. and alligator shoes. Is that the hallmark of a populist candidate or a populist leader?
It's one of them, absolutely. I mean, to be able to stand aside from the supposed corruptors and to say, I'm not one of them, I am different from that, I will change things. I mean, the whole thing's quite hilarious in Perot's case, of course, because he made his entire fortune by being an insider, or at least attempting to be an insider with deals with state governments and federal government, et cetera, feeding off the welfare state, in effect, and using lobbyists of all kinds to try and get friendly legislation. He has done. He has made himself, he has built his fortune at precisely the same kinds of maneuverings that he now condemns as being the reason that the country is falling apart. So it's something amusing about that.
When did his relationship with the federal government begin?
Well, it begins in the 1960s. Perot had his background in the computer industry, and he started his own company in the 1960s, which would be able to provide computer services to large-scale bureaucracies better than others. He realized this first, I believe it was with Texas Blue Shield or Blue Cross, seeing that an opportunity existed for an entrepreneur to step in and provide those kinds of services. And in the late 60s, it became clear that the federal government, state governments would be places to try and get business. And so he did so, and did so quite well all through the 1970s in particular. But in doing so, naturally had to be able to curry favor with leading politicians. And as at the federal level, at the national level, his first important contact was with Richard Nixon in the late 1960s, just before Nixon's election, in fact, appears to be when Perot first met Nixon. And in 1969, at a time when the passions over the war were particularly high, Perot stepped in and did a fair amount of interesting work, private work, all of which was all over the papers. Why nobody's brought this up? Remembered all of this is quite interesting. But in any case, he founded a group called United We Stand to try and galvanize support for the president at a time when anti-war demonstrations were very high.
What kind of influence do you think he had then back in the 60s? Was he a player?
Well, he tried to be. He had a certain public relations impact. I mean, there was no question that the Nixon administration was happy to see a private citizen mounting a private campaign in support, first, of Nixon's policy, not so much for the policy itself, but simply asking Americans to stand behind the president. And then the little caper late in 69 and then in early 1970 when he went over to Hanoi to try and, or he tried to deliver Christmas meals to the prisoners of war in Vietnam, a very selfless act, in fact, on the surface, and one which any American could support, I suppose, but at the same time, distracting attention away from the issues surrounding the war itself onto the humanitarian issues, which were genuine, absolutely genuine, but at the same time, taking some of the political heat off Nixon. I'm sure the Nixon administration was happy about that. From what I've been able to put together, however, Perot wanted to be more of an insider than the Nixon people were happy to let him be. There was a certain amount of finagling around the pressure that the Social Security Administration was putting on his company about some of the more questionable practices it was indulging in, and the administration managed to get some of the heat taken off Perot. But Perot apparently, and this comes secondhand reports from Nixon insiders, liked to propose various policy initiatives, some of which the Nixon people thought were completely off the wall. And it was apparently around the Nixon people's, they just got fed up of dealing with Ross Perot's strange ideas, that the relationship degenerated in around 1972-73, just in time for Watergate, but apparently there was no connection between the two.
I'm speaking with Sean Wilentz. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, and we're talking about Ross Perot. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is Sean Wilentz, and he's a professor of history at Princeton University. How do you think Ross Perot has been able to elude the scrutiny of the press?
By hiding out, a lot of it. I mean, it was an extraordinary campaign last year when you think about it. In the end, I think he and his aides decided that getting out of the race when he did would cost them less than being in public view. That's a retrospective view, but I suspect that may have been part of what was going on. And then, however, even when he was running his race, he stayed away from the mainstream press pretty successfully. He would speak to the press very rarely. When he did, he baited them. And this is another modern populist move. And there's no question that in some circles, Dan Rather is thought of as the great Satan, and Rather just sort of standing in for the mainstream press, that this is the new elite, this is the liberal clerisy out there that's lying to the American people, and if only we could bypass them, we'd be getting the truth. Well, Perot plays to that prejudice. At the same time, he manages to elude the kind of close scrutiny that the press has certainly played to other political leaders.
But why the failure from, at least from your perspective as a history professor, why the failure of the press to do its investigation of Perot?
Absolutely baffling. Absolutely baffling. It was funny. When I wrote this piece that we were talking about earlier, I was asked to review these two books of his, these two manifestos, and to get some political background on Perot. And I went down with a graduate student, an assistant of mine, and we just looked through the New York Times files, something that a historian does as first instinct. And there was all this material about Perot in the 60s and 70s, which really hadn't gotten reported, or not reported very much, certainly during the campaign. And sometimes I thought that the reason that none of this got reported is that reporters are so hooked into computers these days that their Nexus or Lexis files only go back to 81. And anything before 81 doesn't exist anymore, or 83, I forget exactly the year, but basically it doesn't exist. And that's unfortunate, to say the least.
As you say, his activities are part of the public record. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder whether the press was somehow afraid of Perot, afraid of taking him on.
Well, that may have been. There is this feeling in the press that the Perot movement is somehow explosive. You don't want to antagonize the Perot movement. That just cowardice, in my view. I mean, the only way to deal with populists is to expose them. That's what the press is about. And certainly, the press has shown in the past an absolute willingness to go after all kinds of people. No, I think it was. Well, two things. First of all, I think there's a general decline in historical consciousness anyway in the United States.
And then that's from top to bottom.
And that's from top to bottom. And the press shares in that. Thereafter, the current story, what's breaking now, the idea of doing a long, thoughtful, reflective background piece on Ross Perot is maybe the last thing on their collective or its collective mind, the press. So that history, or not just history as a motive or not just history as a subject, but history as a way of thinking, has eluded the press more and more. I mean, it's a long way from the days of say Ed Murrow or the other early broadcast journalists. And we're just talking about broadcast journalism now, where a sense of historical importance permeated everything that they did. There's less of that now, and I mean that's a big topic about what's going on in American culture these days.
There is a more independent-minded electorate, less party loyalty to the Democrats or the Republicans. How does Ross Perot then play a part in the erosion of the traditional election process?
Well, to me, Perot at the moment is, a perfectly traditional figure in American politics. Every 30 years or so, Americans' sense of party identity or party loyalty shifts dramatically. That's been true almost from the beginning of party politics back in the 1820s. There are all these great realignments, these great shifts in American political allegiance. Normally, those shifts are signaled by the emergence of some kind of third party, third movement, which becomes a temporary vehicle for people who are shifting from one place to the other. My guess is that that's what Perot's movement has been. What's a bit confusing, it's unclear what the new party system to replace it would look like, and a lot of that depends on what Perot is about. And a lot of that is different because Perot's movement is so much generated by himself rather than any kind of protest party out there. But you saw it, for example, in recent memory with the emergence of Wallace in 68. He became a way for Southern white Democrats to move into the Republican Party. I mean, effectively, that's what occurred. Wallace coming out of the Democratic Party allowed them to do so, although he himself faded. If Ross Perot runs true to form, his movement will fade, but his people will end up moving from one party to the other. Now, in his case...
Can you predict which party?
Well, you know, you can't because his Perot... I mean, I think that Perot's basic appeal is to Republicans. The polling data that I've seen coming out of the election strikes me as showing pretty conclusively that by the end he was drawing more support from Bush than from the Democrats. But where are they going to go? Are they going to end up back in the Democratic Party, many of these people? Depends on what the Democrats do. Are they going to go back with the Republicans? Or might Perot end up becoming, for the first time in American history, a third force with some sticking power? I mean, it's I'm an historian, not a prognosticator. I mean, that's an old line. But still, I it's too early to say.
Well, I thank you, Sean Wilentz, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Sean Wilentz is a professor of history at Princeton. His article about Ross Perot is in the August 9th issue of The New Republic. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the news today. Linda, what stories will you have for us on the show today?
Marty, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman was indicted in New York in connection with the World Trade Center bombing, and we're scurrying around trying to get a story together on that. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on China and Pakistan for the sale of missiles, which violates arms control agreements. Cable TV and the phone company can be in business in the same city, a court has ruled, which changes the nature of the industry a bit if that ruling holds. We have a conversation with one of the Palestinian peace negotiators and a festival in Spain which involves throwing tons of tomatoes.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The late conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein would have been 75 years old today. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's never been a fan of Bernstein's conducting, but Sony has just reissued some long unavailable recordings that Lloyd thinks are among Bernstein's best.
Leonard Bernstein, the conductor, is probably most famous for his Mahler symphonies. He was the first conductor to record them all, and those recordings were a turning point in the public's awareness of Mahler. For my taste, however, Mahler is intense enough already without any goosing from Bernstein. In fact, very little of Bernstein's conducting ever really interested me. Every now and then I'd see a favorable reference to Bernstein's Haydn, but Haydn's wit and elegance struck me as remote from Bernstein's excesses. And Bernstein's Haydn recordings from the late 1960s and 70s didn't stay in print for long. Now Sony is releasing more than 100 Bernstein CDs in a new series called The Royal Edition, for reasons I'll explain later. Among the first to appear are his Haydn recordings, and the last composer I'd have expected Bernstein to do well turns out to be the one he does best. Bernstein's brilliant, extroverted energy keeps the classical formality from turning effete, while Haydn's very classicism and Enlightenment wisdom helps keep Bernstein in check. He tunes in to Haydn's lyric impulse, so the melodies really sing. And since he not only gets but enjoys Haydn's jokes, he doesn't have to overstate the punchlines. The New York Philharmonic gives Bernstein the perfect balance of zest and refinement. Most important, there's a real emotional center. Listen to the tenderness and gravity of the Variations movement of the Symphony No. 88.
Thank you.
Bernstein's Haydn has been issued in 5 CD boxes. Besides the marvelous Symphony No. 88, there are the 6 Paris Symphonies, the 12 great London Symphonies, Haydn's late oratorio, The Creation, and 3 of Haydn's magnificent masses. The soloists in The Creation, Judith Raskin, Alexander Young, and John Reardon, are especially good. They're vocally more pleasing and stylistically more coherent than the soloists Bernstein used in his recordings of the masses several years later. Other conductors, especially Sir Thomas Beecham, have done the London Symphonies superlatively. I've also been enjoying Sigiswald Kuijken's Haydn performances on original instruments. But Bernstein's Paris Symphonies, which include The Hen, The Bear, and Marie Antoinette's alleged favorite, the one called The Queen, are the best complete set I know. Oh yes, Sony calls this entire Bernstein series the Royal Edition because each box of CDs has a watercolor by Prince Charles on the cover. They're all pictures of the English countryside, derivative, old-fashioned, but very pretty and beautifully reproduced, though in the CD format they look like miniatures. What they have to do with Leonard Bernstein, though, or Haydn, or any other composer in this Bernstein series, is a question that only the marketing department at Sony can answer.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed some new CDs of Leonard Bernstein conducting Haydn from Sony's Royal Edition series. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Bob Alls, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, 250,000 years of history preserved in an ice core. We talk with scientist Paul Majewski, who heads the Greenland Ice Sheet Project. From the ice, they can pinpoint the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the signing of the Clean Air Act. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.